I must admit, I feel a bit like a pariah up here. I'm both a pom and a banker. Probably not a great combination, but anyway. Thank you very much, Marco, for that very generous introduction. And I'd also like to thank him for not turning around to me for the first time in a very long time and saying, should we let our guests continue to enjoy themselves, or do you want to begin your speech? Well, unfortunately, I'm going to begin my speech. I guess, just by way of a quick background, I've been involved in the PFI since inception, back in the early to mid-1990s, so I bear the scars associated with that. Of course, that was when the then Conservative government wanted to bring private sector efficiencies into public sector procurement for large-scale infrastructure, and they saw PFI as essentially a viable alternative to traditional procurement methods and a way of harnessing private sector efficiencies with the public sector. And I guess I've been very fortunate in that by being involved in PFI at the outset, it's enabled me to be part of that machine that helped shape and develop PFI policy in the UK. And I guess my first experience, which is in common with many other countries, was advising the Highways Agency on their first DBFO roads programme. And in a sense, that was the forerunner of PFI in the UK. And as we all know, PFI in its various guises has been embraced worldwide. And in fact, I met somebody the other day who's actually advising the governments of Nigeria and Gabon, believe it or not, on how they might go about establishing a PFI framework. Inevitably, PFI always starts in the transportation sector and then migrates into other areas. And so in the UK, we've seen it in education, in health, water, and more recently, actually, in social housing and the waste sector. Institutionally, I've been at RBC for the best part of 6 years now, and we are probably at any given point in time advising on around 35 to 40 PPPs globally. And our most recent mandate was actually a couple of days ago when the province of Quebec appointed us to advise them on exploring alternative funding methods as it might relate to their PPP program going forward. So in a sense, today is very relevant. So there are three areas that I would like to explore with you today. First, what is the state of the funding market? And I know there's been a lot of discussion around that already. And how do we find ourselves in the position that we do today? I think, secondly, how are different governments around the world responding to this funding crisis? And what actions are they taking to kickstart the market? And finally, I'd like to explore with you today what are some of the ways that we think could unblock this funding logjam? And of course, my comments are largely going to be in the context of what goes on in the European marketplace, but I think inevitably there is some relevance and overlap with how things might be done here in Australia. So what needs to be done? I think first and foremost, I think governments around the world have been very slow to respond to the funding crisis within infrastructure more generally and specifically PFI. And only now do I think they're beginning to tackle the problem. And I think there are a number of ways that they can improve the position. They can improve the existing procurement process. It's simply not working at the moment. Bidders are unable to put in committed finance. And in fact, it is anything but committed finance. And terms that are being submitted, frankly, are increasingly meaningless and fanciful. And I'm sort of reminded of an example when we received bids on a project in the UK a couple of weeks ago. And this was a process where we were asking for committed finance. And bidder one came back and said, we'll underwrite the financing provided the banks are able to sell down to their take and hold position within 6 months of financial close oh, and by the way, if they can't do that, we're going to put it back to government. Bidder two said they would underwrite the financing, but only on conditional that there was unlimited pricing flex within the deal. And bidder three simply said, we can't get any committed finance at all because all the other banks are taken up by the other two bidders. But don't worry, because when we get to preferred bidder, we'll just take the banks from the other two. And there's a sort of comical element to it, but nevertheless, I think it does underlie the problems that we currently face. So let's start with some good news. And in a sense, I think a lot of speakers have touched upon this already. The good news, I think, is that governments around the world see infrastructure as a means of stimulating economic activity. At the end of the day, it's part of our everyday lives, we all use it, and it's an outward manifestation of the general health of the economy. However, it's clearly at a crossroads. It's become too highly geared. It's a consequence of over-optimistic growth assumptions and a presumption, not an assumption, but a presumption that it was only a matter of time before these deals would get refinanced, banks would get paid out, and shareholders would walk off into the sunset with enhanced returns. Credit became too easy to come by, and financial institutions were literally falling over themselves to lend cheap money. Well, the merry-go-round has stopped. Those days are long gone, and I think they're very unlikely to return, at least for the foreseeable future. And whilst my comments today are very much focused on Greenfield PPP, the problems are very similar, if not worse, in the Brownfield market due to the distress of many financial sponsors and the massive refinancing risks that have been taken. So very quickly moving onto the bank market. So why is it then that despite the strong fundamentals of the PPP market, has the PPP market been so badly affected? And if I think we take the bank market to start with, they became the dominant source of lending in the early part of the decade. And why was that? I think a lot of that was actually in response to the development of the monoline wrapped bond market, and a realisation that if banks wanted to compete with the capital markets, they needed to lend long-term and on competitive terms. And when I started off in PFI back in the mid-90s, it was very unusual for banks to go much beyond 12 years. It then migrated to 15, to 20, and so on and so forth. And as, however, the wider financial crisis has gripped the financial community, so banks' balance sheets have become increasingly constrained and their funding costs have ballooned. So the attraction of lending long-term into what is considered an illiquid market has become increasingly unattractive. And the problem has been further exacerbated by the collapse of the long-dated infrastructure lending banks. And I've named but a few up there on the slide. And also, the failure of the syndication market has meant that banks are now having to take a take-and-hold, long-term take-and-hold view, where previously they had taken comfort that they would get refinanced post-construction completion. And the consequence of all this is that banks are redirecting their lending towards higher grade, shorter tenor, and higher margin business. Lending opportunities are being evaluated on a totally different set of criteria. Banks are continuing to support key clients and are only contemplating other business if it can be justified on pure economic grounds, with very high returns being targeted. At the same time as the massive contraction in the banking market, we're all aware, so access to the bond market has become restricted due to the failure of the monolines, who had been traditionally the route for accessing the bond markets in a number of jurisdictions, particularly UK and here in Australia. And yet, and I think this is an important point to make, global bond investors are still attracted to the regulated and essential services characteristics of the infrastructure market. and we'll explore a little bit later on how I think the institutional market can be attracted back to PPPs without the need for the monolines. The consequence of the contraction in the banking market and the failure of the monolines has been that there are a number of significant PPPs stranded around the world, where the proposed terms that have been submitted have become increasingly fanciful, particularly for the larger transactions. And governments now need to find a solution. And I think they can help in a number of ways. First, by ensuring that the procurement process itself helps lenders to get their credit approvals and reach financial close, rather than encouraging a situation where undeliverable offers are encouraged, which will never materialise or will be completely renegotiated once the bidder gets to a preferred position. And I think the other way that it can help is by promoting new product which banks and investors now want to buy. I want to look at the market now in some of the jurisdictions where PPP has become an established procurement route and what governments are now doing, and then I will look at some additional solutions. And let's just put it into some sort of context. The number of PFI deals closed in the UK over the last 12 months has halved and is at its lowest level since 1996. The same can be attributed to both Europe and Canada. So the funding crisis in PPP is a global phenomenon. I've actually listed a number of the landmark deals at the back of this presentation, if anybody's interested, that actually closed during 2008, and it is quite interesting. However, the list of the stranded deals is much longer. Don't worry, I'm not going to go into all these details in any sort of all these projects into any sort of detail. But I think there are some salient points that come out of these projects. One is that none of these projects are unlikely to happen without a significant government contribution in some shape or form, and or the increased involvement of the EIB. And I think this pattern is likely to continue for the foreseeable future, particularly for any deals over 200 million sterling. Canada also has a significant programme of large PPPs, and again, it's worth noting that these aren't going to happen either in the current climate without some form of provincial support. And one of the earlier speakers today mentioned the Portman Highway, which, as we all know, closed a couple of weeks ago as a design and build, fully funded by the province. So what are governments going to do about the logjam? If we look at Europe, it's clear that EIB is leading the charge and providing additional liquidity and relaxing its lending criteria. In fact, the most recent deal to close in the UK was the M80. It closed in January of this year. It was around 300 million sterling, but it wouldn't have closed without the EIB lending more than 50% of the project. They've also established what they call the European PPP Expertise Centre, EPEC, which is a collaboration between the EIB and European Union member states, which is intended to share experience and best practice amongst themselves. Let's move to the UK. And you'll all be aware that in the UK, Treasury has recently announced a programme entitled Safeguarding Government Infrastructure Investment. And they've set aside, at least for the time being, up to £2 billion, which they will set aside to ensure that some of the backlog of PFIs that currently exist will actually close as swiftly as possible. And the intention is to lend alongside commercial bank lenders as well as the EIB. But it's seen very much as a short-term fix, whilst a take the time to try and establish a longer term solution. France, which arguably has been the most proactive government in Europe to address the issues facing PPP, is following a similar, I guess, going down a similar line to the UK. They have a number of very large infrastructure projects, particularly in the transportation arena, and they have earmarked somewhere in the region of 18 billion euros to assist PFI to happen. The only difference perhaps with the UK is that it looks like the assistance is going to come in the form of guarantees rather than direct lending. In Canada, it's a bit unclear. I think the jury is still out in terms of how best they're going to tackle the problem. And in any case, I suspect it's going to be a problem tackled from province to province, each province favouring their own solutions. But it will almost invariably take the form of some form of government contribution. And one of the speakers, I think it was Mark earlier today, mentioned how the US seems to be committed to infrastructure spend, including PPP, but that the different states that make up the United States are moving at very different speeds. He also made reference to the I-595 in Florida, which closed very recently, and at least demonstrated that there still does remain bank appetite for well-structured and well-priced PPP. So what else can governments do? I think in all cases, governments appear to have put programs in place which in theory should stimulate market activity. However, the practicalities of making any of these programs work, especially where they involve co-lending, I think is more complex than anybody realises. And in this next section, I want to look at some of the alternatives, which may either complement government programs or actually be alternatives to them. I think first, what else can governments do? And I think increasingly this is the case. I think they can recognise that the current approach to require bidders to provide committed finance at bid stage is simply not working. This is because the secondary market has failed. Syndication no longer exists, which means that lending is now being done on a club basis. There are fewer banks. Everybody wants to be an MLA. Everybody wants to secure the hedging economics. And bidders are still trying to tie up banks on an exclusive basis, destroying competition. There are simply not enough banks to support more than one bidder unless you're talking about the smaller deals. Fewer banks means that the large deals are unfundable. And we believe that the typical size of commitments has reduced to around 50 million sterling or equivalent, and that there are probably no more than a dozen banks active in the long-term PPP market. The result of all of the above is that there are fewer banks, limited to no competition, unreliable commitments, and the lowest common denominator reigns, and government has lost its negotiating position. So one of the things that I think government needs to do is to concentrate on process and make sure that it is still in control. And one of the things that they can look at is running funding competitions post-preferred bidder. This has been tried in the UK, and in a contracting market, it has quite a lot of attractions, not least because it ensures that all the available capacity or appetite in the market is tapped, and it guarantees success for the successful banks without the need for banks to tie up precious capital supporting one of three bidders. A more radical approach, and one actually which is commonplace in the acquisition world, is for the public sector to take control and arrange the finance itself, which it would then make available to the preferred bidder. Government should have as much weight as any private sector bidder in pulling banks into the funding, arguably more so. I do know that if the province of British Columbia rang up the Royal Bank of Canada and said that they needed a hospital project to be funded, that the Royal Bank of Canada would struggle to say no. And I suspect the same applies elsewhere. It would also provide government and the private sector with the comfort that the funding is both realistic and achievable. And from the lender's perspective, they are assured of being involved in the financing so that they are comforted that they're not tying up capital needlessly as part of a funding group. And any concerns around it being and detracting from the competitive process, I think, can be put to one side, because at the end of the day, bidders will still be free to offer alternative and more competitive funding solutions if they can source them. I think the other thing that governments can do is to promote the development of new product. And so let's have a look at some of them. Even without the credit insurance provided by the monoline insurers, bond investors, mainly pension funds and insurance companies, remain a natural fit for long-term infrastructure assets. This market remains very much open, perhaps more so in a European context than here, but nevertheless it is. And what is clear from the amount of activity that has taken place in the last 18 months in the UK and Europe, specifically in the utilities sector, is that bond investors have a strong preference for bonds rated strong investment grade, at least triple B plus or single A minus. And to date, of course, bond finance projects in Europe have been structured to achieve a low investment grade or triple B minus credit rating, with the wrap having been purchased to improve the bond rating to triple A. And it doesn't take that much to achieve an improvement in the underlying rating from triple B minus to triple B plus single A. There need to be a number of structural changes, but the one that the rating agencies focus on most is around construction risk mitigation and the need for more construction level support, whether it be in the form of bank LCs or surety bonding. And I know Wall mentioned earlier that this has become prohibitively expensive, but there are perhaps alternatives to that in the form of a government guarantee effectively replacing the monoline through the construction period, or indeed maybe some form of compromise in the form of debt underpinning. And you only have to look at the Canadian marketplace to see that there has been quite a lot of success in the number of unwrapped bonds that have been delivered there, where the level of construction support has been sufficient to get the bonds rated single A minus. There are other issues to address, which I don't really intend to go through now, namely around confidentiality and a transparent flow of information to investors, and also who fulfills the role of the monolines as controlling creditor. But these have been overcome in other jurisdictions, and there's no reason why they couldn't be overcome here. Mini-perm structures are common in North America, and they actually seem to be the direction in which a number of European PFIs are heading. The concept is quite easy. You're matching the different stages of a project with the funders that are the most natural investors in the related risks. So the bank market takes the construction and the bedding down risk, and then the project is refinanced into the capital markets for long-term yield. And strong incentives need to be put in place to encourage that to happen in the form of dividend lockups, cash sweeps, step up in margins, and so on and so forth. I guess the principal question that needs to be asked is who on the mini-perm structure is taking the refinancing risk. Is it the private sector or is it the public sector? And I think on highly geared structures such as PPP, it's likely that the public sector will need to take that refinancing risk. But will banks be interested in this new form of finance? I think it's difficult to determine unless the banks are sufficiently comforted through the structure that a refinancing will actually happen. Otherwise, it's long-term lending in all but name. And I've just put an example up of the largest car park in Europe, the M25, which is beginning to be structured like what we call a soft mini-perm. But it certainly didn't start off like this, and my guess is it won't end up like this. This is a funding which amounts to somewhere in the region of 1.2 billion sterling. It will involve a combination of commercial bank debt, EIB, and government lending. It's being structured as 27-year debt, but with refinancing incentives in years 7 and 10. That will be in the form of margin step-ups and 100% cash sweeps. And there is a strong construction package underpinning it, LCs for somewhere in the region of 10% of the construction price, and a joint and several guarantee from the parent companies for 50% of the construction price. And it has probably an implied investment grade rating of the around BBB-, with pricing starting at 250, rising to 350. And apparently there are still 20 banks interested. How many of them, though, will ultimately turn up at the party? And my view is that the banks will struggle with this unless there is a sufficient refinancing incentive for them to get comfortable. And I think as it's currently proposed, that refinancing incentive doesn't necessarily exist. And I guess the final thing I wanted just to touch upon was really around government debt, whether it be financed by the public sector, either through grant, debt, or guarantee. And actually it's quite interesting in the UK that a range of models similar to that have already been tried and tested, but to a large extent abandoned. We're talking in a different world now, the drivers are very different. And I think the UK, amongst European countries, is the latest to opt for co-lending. However, I do think there are major issues around conflicts of interest between government as a lender and government as the procuring authority, which need to be thought through and resolved. And I leave a thought in your minds as to actually whether this will help or hinder the bank market. Will banks see it simply as a reason to withdraw from long-term lending? And will sponsors, in a sense, be let off the hook because they don't necessarily need to bring their relationship banks with them? I think it will only work if it's harnessed with a fundamental restructuring of the underlying risk. I think that, in a sense, takes us back to my previous slide about mini-perms and strong refinancing incentives. So to conclude, and I think I'm sort of concluding on a reasonably upbeat way, I think appropriately structured and priced infrastructure remains a very attractive asset class. I think the sudden loss of appetite for long-term lending is not an issue of credit quality. And I do think governments can help in a variety of ways, both in terms of improving the procurement process and ensuring that the maximum available capacity among capital is sourced. I think they can also encourage the development of new product and stimulate new sources of finance. And I think, relatively speaking, a lot of this is easy to implement without changing the underlying principles of PFI. As I come to the end of my presentation, I'm actually reminded of a presentation I made a couple of months ago, when I was about to go up and make it, I remember turning to my neighbour and saying that I really didn't like making presentations, and he sort of looked rather quizzically at me and said, "Do you?" He said, "I don't mind making speeches at all, but what really bores me is listening to them." Well, I hope I haven't bored you too much, but I've given you some food for thought. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much for that. Might like to come join me here.
There we go, Bradley.
I'm Bradley Van, thank you. You mentioned the use of debt funding competition after the first editor. The problem then is who's actually determined the appropriate risk allocation from the bank perspective during the evaluation stage, because otherwise you end up with an elongated first editor negotiation, which is something that most CBDs are trying to seek to avoid now.
I think that's probably right, but I think in the current environment, you either have an elongated sort of tender process running up to preferred bidder because you still have the issues around sourcing committed finance in an environment where I don't think for the larger projects there is sufficient bank debt capacity to be able to support three bidders, or you actually have those prolonged negotiations post preferred bidder when you're actually addressing the capacity issues head on in terms of actually determining the preferred bidder and actually sourcing the debt at that point in time. I think the dynamics have changed such that I do think a funding competition post-preferred bidder is probably the only realistic way to go. Because I think at the moment what's happening, and I gave an example of that, is that actually nobody is putting committed finance on the table. Which has any meaning to it, and in a sense all they're doing is using that as a position to get to preferred bidder and then renegotiating it. I think Canada was quite a good case in point, that prior to this credit crisis they had a fairly strict procurement process whereby committed finance at bid submission literally meant committed finance at bid submission. And they compressed the period from preferred bidder to financial close to around a month to 2 months. I think in an environment where banks aren't really prepared to commit for any period of time whatsoever without introducing pricing flex and in some cases structural flex, that's probably not an option anymore. And so really the key to my mind about running a competition, funding competition post preferred bidder, is actually sourcing the maximum capacity available in the marketplace.
Yes, just over there. Actually, I'd like to have a go at that after you have, because Adelaide to Darwin was very interesting, I think, in that respect, but I will let you go first.
I'm not sure I know the answer, in truth, because I don't think those issues have either been fully thought through and certainly not worked out. And it really comes back to one of the comments that I made on my slide, which is I think there's a massive and inherent conflict of interest here. Where deals are co-lended, you know, government debt on the one hand alongside commercial bank debt and or the EIB in terms of voting rights, etc. Those are issues that I think are obviously, I mean, we're not involved in the M25, which in a sense is perhaps unfortunate because that's probably the test case in the UK that's going on at the moment in terms of how these issues might be resolved. And at one point I know there was a discussion whereby government would have equal voting rights but only to the extent that there was a commercial impact on the deal relating to a decision that had to be made, i.e. if the tenor was to be extended, if the amortisation schedule was to be amended and so on and so forth. But I think all these issues are very relevant issues. I don't think they've been thought through, and I can see it being a bit of a minefield in truth.
Terry, if I could answer that question just very quickly by reference to Adelaide to Darwin, where, of course, the way that project was structured, as probably a lot of you may recall, there was a significant input from government right up front before the banks kicked in. So, as you say, yes, it was a minefield because we spent months negotiating precisely what the rights of each would be in terms of priorities, in terms of the security package, etc., etc. In part, what it means is, and I think someone mentioned it before, government has a different perspective in terms of the debt, further the risk allocation further downstream. Suddenly, there's greater interest in the DNC and the PAMEC under that, etc., etc. So, to some extent, you know, and there were hundreds of millions of dollars of government money in there before the banks kicked in. A lot of that was thought through there, not in any particular way, if you like. There were no guiding principles, but we had to negotiate from scratch. That's between public and private sector there.
No, it wasn't. That's a fair point. It wasn't debt as such, though it was a straight government contribution. But very much, it was. We approached it in the same way because, of course, you know, there were a lot of payments being made up front where if things defaulted, you'll end up with a dirty great big scar across the middle of Australia and not much else. So a lot of the issues were quite similar, I think.
I mean, I do know that the starting point that the UK government is adopting is that they should have identical and equal voting rights to the commercial lenders. But as I said, I think that in practice will be very difficult to achieve. And it also comes back to a point I made in my presentation, which is, you know, government co-lending, I think, is wonderful in terms of addressing a short-term liquidity crisis and getting some of these deals closed. But will the consequence be of it be that banks actually, it might force banks to withdraw from the market to some extent, in part because the intercreditor issues will be just too difficult to resolve. You know, and what protection will the banks have, particularly in circumstances where government lending is greater than 50% of the financing requirement?
Any final questions?
Over at the back.
Thank you. David Morse, Melbourne Water. I have a question as a POM to a POM. I'm very interested in your novel solution for funding PPPs by privatising the bank sector. By privatising the bank sector.
What, you mean requiring government to raise the debt on behalf of of the bidders?
Yeah, circular solution.
Well, it's something that is very common, as I mentioned, in the acquisition world, where, you know, a seller of an asset puts together the funding, which he then makes available to prospective purchasers. The purchaser is then free to either take up that funding or indeed to source its own funding if it believes that he can do it on a more competitive basis. I think one of the reasons why I think it's worthy of consideration is that in an environment where capital is scarce and where invariably there's more than two or three bidders, certainly more than one or two bidders on each and every project, maybe actually government has greater pull in terms of bringing those banks together and actually constructing a financing package which they're comfortable is both deliverable and achievable, and which actually ensures that the banks, as part of that process, share in the success. I think one of the challenges that PPP faces at the moment in an environment where there is a scarcity of capital is that, you know, why do banks necessarily want to tie up capital by supporting one of three bidders? When actually, you know, that's not a good use of capital at all, and they would much prefer to be in an environment where they actually know that if they're going to tie up capital, that's capital that's actually going to be used. So, you know, I think it's just something that is worth exploring, though I accept that it throws a number of challenges up.